articles popped up on my browser. He had duped the media with an in-person hoax, claiming to be Dominique Strauss-Kahn's neighbor immediately after rape charges were leveled against the wealthy French politician and former head of the International Monetary Fund. Weave, then utterly destitute, managed to slip his comments into hundreds of newspapers. No journalist bothered to fact-check him. Despite the prosecutor's claims, however, Strauss-Kahn is already meeting his neighbors. An infamous computer hacker who lives in the corporate apartment building on Broadway claims he has already met the Frenchman, and he is an okay guy. "We're all like one big breakfast club in there," Andrew Orenheimer, 26, was reported as saying, in reference to the 1985 classic film about five high school students trapped in Saturday detention. In lulls we trust. So if Weave, like so many trolls, dishes out his actions on mixed platters of truth and lies, is it possible to determine whether he was actually in the room when the lulls first whooshed off the tip of a tongue? To probe this question further, let's turn to Encyclopedia Dramatica, ED, a stunningly detailed online compendium cataloging troll mechanics, history, gore, and lore. Despite bearing the title Encyclopedia, it strives neither for neutrality nor objectivity. ED is indeed encyclopedic in its detail, but it is also outrageous in tone and riddled with lies. What ED does well, and in this way it actually achieves a strange measure of objectivity, is display the moral kinetics of trolling. Is ED's etymologizing of the lulls, a snippet of which is provided here, fact or fable? Lulls is a corruption of LOL, which stands for laugh out loud, signifying laughter at someone else's expense. This makes it inherently superior to lesser forms of humor. Anonymous gets big lulls from pulling random pranks. The pranks are always posted on the internet. Just as the element of surprise transforms the physical act of love into something beautiful, the anguish of a laughed-at victim transforms LOL into lulls, making it longer, girthier, and more pleasurable. Lulls is engaged in by internet users who have witnessed one major economic-slash-environmental-slash-political disaster too many, and who thus view a state of voluntary, gleeful sociopathy over the world's current apocalyptic state as superior to being continually emo. The term lulls was first coined by James, an original Encyclopedia Dramatica administrator, and the term became very popular on that website. The nickname originated sometime in early 2001 when James, his real name, the TH suffix being a pun on his faggotry and his small peener, was having a conversation with a lisping homosexual. James was being referred to as James because of the person's speech impediment. In June 2001, James decided to use James as his LiveJournal account name. Don't let him fool you. James craves the cock. According to information from multiple interviews, including one with ED's sharp and witty founder, Sherrod DeGrippo, Weave did indeed participate in the conference call when James coined the term, and James is in fact gay. I never inquired about his lisp. Today, the lulls can encompass lighthearted jokes as well, and are utilized and enjoyed by many internet nerds around the world. But at its inception, its demeanor was conceived as cruel. Laughter at the expense or the misfortune of others is how trolls like to define it. Lulls is a quintessential example of what folklorists define as argot, specialized and esoteric terminology used by a subcultural group. Since argot is so opaque and particular, it functions to enact secrecy, or, at minimum, erect some very stiff social boundaries. As an anthropologist, it is tempting, no matter how ridiculous it seems, to view lulls in terms of epistemology, through the social production of knowledge. At one level, the lulls functions as an epistemic object, stabilizing a set of experiences by making them available for reflection. For decades, there was no term for the lulls, but trolls and hackers nevertheless experienced the distinctive pleasures of pranking. Once a name like Lulz comes into being, it opens the very practice it names to further reflection by its practitioners. Trolls now pontificate over the meaning of the Lulz, employing the term to designate particularly satisfying acts, whether or not they are intentionally done for the Lulz, and also to diagnose situations lacking in Lulz, which, of course, demands reparatory courses of action. Just what does the term do or signify which no other word can? This is harder to convey. But if we keep in mind that Lulz derives from the acronym LOL, laugh out loud, it becomes easier to see that Lulz is primarily about humor. LOLs are familiar to everyone who has ever sent a joke to someone by email. Lulz are darker, acquired most often at someone's expense, prone to misfiring, and occasionally bordering on disturbing or hateful speech, except, of course, when they cross the border entirely. Thank you, rape jokes. Lulz are unmistakably imbued with danger and mystery, and thus speak foremost to the pleasures of transgression. We can see the defining features of Lulz in Weave's AT&T affair, not in his exposure of the security hole, but in the way he got respectable newscasters all over the United States to utter the word goatsy, unwittingly referencing one of the most disgusting images on the internet. In practice, Lulzy activity defies boundaries, but also re-erects them. There is a divide between people who are merely LOLing on the internet, without really knowing what the internet is or where it came from or how it works on the inside, and those who are Lulzing, meaning hackers, trolls, etc., and know exactly what the underbelly is about. The Lulz are both a form of cultural differentiation and a tool or weapon used to attack, humiliate, and defame the unwitting normal LOLers, often without them even realizing that an entire culture is aligned against them. Usually, the Lulz are inside jokes, but often they are equal opportunity. Lulz may provoke laughter not just among trolls, but outsiders as well. The price of admission is just a bit of knowledge. LOLers can be drawn into the world of Lulz thanks to websites populated by trolls like Encyclopedia Dramatica, 4chan, and Something Awful, which disseminate this knowledge to anyone who cares to look for it. Those who find it may choose to run away very quickly, or they might become the next generation of trolls. The Lulz show how easily and casually trolls can upend our sense of security by invading private spaces and exposing confidential information. Targets receive scores of unpaid pizzas at home, or have their unlisted phone numbers published, social security numbers leaked, private communications posted, credit card numbers doxed, and hard drive content seeded. Trolls enjoy desecrating anything remotely sacred, as cultural theorist Whitney Phillips conveys in her astute characterization of trolls as agents of cultural digestion who scavenge the landscape, repurpose the most offensive material, then shove the resulting monstrosities into the faces of an unsuspecting populace. In short, any information thought to be personal, secure, or sacred is a prime target for sharing or defilement in a multitude of ways. Lulz-oriented actions puncture the consensus around our politics and ethics, our social lives, and our aesthetic sensibilities. Any presumption of our world's inviolability becomes a weapon. Trolls invalidate that world by gesturing toward the possibility for internet geeks to destroy it, to pull the carpet from under us whenever they feel the urge. I came to trolls just as a subset of them was experiencing a crucial transformation. Increasingly, people working under the aegis of Anonymous began pursuing activism. Given the seedy underbelly I have just described, the development was beyond surprising. However, it was not without historical precedent. I recognized trolls as kin to the tricksters of myth. After all, I am an anthropologist, and tricksters are a time-honored topic of anthropological rumination. To trick or to treat. The trickster archetype comes replete with a diverse number of icons and often delightful tales. Greek and Roman mythology brought some of these figures into the heart of Western culture. the mercurial Hermes and the bacchanalian Dionysus, among others. In West African and Caribbean folklores, the role falls to Anansi, a spider who sometimes imparts knowledge or wisdom, and sometimes casts doubt or seeds confusion. Ishu, the god of communication and crossroads, is similarly ambiguous. Known for orchestrating chaotic scenarios that force human decisions, he can be a kind teacher or an agent of destruction. Among indigenous North Americans, Raven initiates change by will or by accident, and Coyote is a selfish beast who will trick any being, human or animal, to satisfy his appetites. The Western conception of the trickster has, since the medieval period, often been delivered in literature. Puck, the shrewd and knavish sprite who misleads night wanderers laughing at their harm in A Midsummer Night's Dream, was not an invention of Shakespeare's, but has roots in a mischievous fairy of Celtic folklore. The shapeshifter Loki of Nordic mythology has recently reappeared in Hollywood films, mostly as a bland version of his mythological self, and still serves as a reminder of the capricious, vindictive role the trickster can perform. Tricksters are united by a few characteristics, such as the burning desire to defy or defile rules, norms, and laws. Often lacking both impulse control and the ability to experience shame, they are outrageous and unfiltered in their speech. Some tricksters are driven by a higher calling, like Loki, who sometimes works for the gods. Though true to his fearsome nature, he sometimes causes problems for them. Many are propelled by curiosity and voracious appetite. They rarely plan their actions, choosing instead an unbridled spontaneity that translates into a wily unpredictability. While capriciousness often underwrites successful trickster exploits, it can also trip trolls up. Trickster tales are not didactic and moralizing, but reveal their lessons playfully. They can function normatively, when parents offer scary stories to dissuade kids from misbehaving, or critically, allowing norms to be laid bare for folk philosophical challenge. Lewis Hyde, who has written extensively on the trickster motif, notes that the origins, liveliness, and durability of cultures requires that there be a space for figures whose function is to uncover and disrupt the very things the cultures are based on. It is not difficult to imagine the troll and Anonymous as contemporary trickster figures. They are provocateurs and saboteurs who dismantle convention while occupying a liminal zone. They are well-positioned to impart lessons, regardless of their intent. Their actions need not be accepted, much less endorsed, to extract positive value. We may see them as edifying us with liberating or terrifying perspectives, symptomatic of underlying problems that deserve scrutiny, functioning as a positive force toward renewal, or as distorting and confusing shadows. The trickster becomes one heuristic, certainly not the only or primary one, for understanding the sources, the myriad effects, and especially the Janus face of morally slippery entities like trolls and Anonymous. Before we get to Anonymous proper, it is worth taking a brief, incomplete tour through the vibrant tradition of trolling / tricksterdom on the internet. The nature of the internet, a network built on software, makes it ideal for both play and exploitation. It is like a petri dish for pranking. Indeed, hackers, and later trolls, have been at this sort of behavior for a long time. But it is only recently that some of these activities have attained a more visible, publicly available mythological status. For example, gathered in the Encyclopedia Dramatica are copious links to cases of historical techno-tricksterism. By exploring these lineages, we can better understand what makes Anonymous, both the trolls and activists, distinctive among a broader pantheon of technological tricksters. A brief natural history of internet tricksterdom, or a genealogy of a lack of morals. Weave is a troll's troll, a rare standout in a field that mostly spawns so many garden varieties. Troll ancestry boasts a rather eclectic and varied cast of characters, Trolling was common in the hacker underground, a place for subversive hackers who thrived in the 1980s and 1990s, seeking out forbidden knowledge by rummaging around, uninvited, in other people's computers. But even they have to thank their direct ancestors, the phone freaks, for the aesthetics of audacity. Fusing technological spelunking with mischief, phone freaks illegally entered the telephone system by recreating the audio frequencies used by the system to route calls. They did it to learn and explore, to be sure, but the thrill of transgression was equally integral to the joy of freaking. In the 1960s and 1970s, freaks would use their skills to congregate on telephone conference party lines. Freaking attracted some blind kids who found a source of freedom in connecting with others on the phone. Over the telephone wires, from near and far, people who couldn't see each other would meet to chat, gossip, share technological tidbits, and plan and execute pranks. Lots of pranks. Naturally, most of these pranks involved phone calls. While most of them were lighthearted, a few exhibited a fearsome bite. Phil Lapsley, a historian of freaks, recounts an infamous 1974 hoax where freaks exploited a rare bug in the phone system to reroute all calls made to residents of Santa Barbara, California, to a phony emergency worker who would warn, "There has been a nuclear explosion in Santa Barbara and all the telephone lines are out." Weave, no stranger to history, adores phone pranks and sees himself as an inheritor of this illustrious lineage. The end of the analog phone network, after the divestiture of Ma Bell, the affectionate name given to AT&T by freaks, spelled the end of the golden age of freaking. It was largely replaced by the exploration of computer networks, giving rise to the hacker underground, which peaked in the 1990s. Although many of these underground hackers acquired, circulated, and produced technical knowledge, scouting for security vulnerabilities and edifying technical curiosities, they were also connoisseurs of forbidden fruit. Thus, it is no wonder that their actions expanded from strictly technical engagements and into ones that included mockery, spectacle, and transgression. They quickly distinguished their politics and ethics from the university hackers of MIT, Carnegie Mellon, and Stanford. These hackers, who in the 1960s stayed up all night to access their beloved computers otherwise tied up for official use during the day, have been chronicled majestically by journalist Stephen Levy. Though these early hackers also had an affinity for pranking, they abided by a more robust ethos of transparency and access than underground hackers. Many underground hackers were puckish in their pranking and hacking pursuits. They were mischief makers and merry wanderers of the network. There was, however, a cohort of underground hackers who more closely resembled the Loki archetype in their network jaunts and haunts. When I interview hackers who were active in the 1990s about their trolling activities, the conversation inevitably turns toward a discussion of the most feared hacker-slash-troll of the era, Euphoria, eerily similar to Lulz in its figuration. So terrifying was this troll's reign that every time I utter Euphoria to one of his contemporaries, their demeanor blackens and proceedings assume an unmatched seriousness. Euphoria is Canadian. More notoriously, this troll was founder, president, and dictator for life of hacker group Brotherhood of Wares. BOW for short. Wares is pirated software. BOW sought to poke fun at bulletin board system Wares groups. According to a former member whom I chatted with online, the paramilitary wing of BOW, called Haggis, short for Hackers Against Geeks in Snowsuits, went on cruel hacking and pranking campaigns against targets ranging from corporations, law-abiding white hat hackers, and info security gurus, to basically anyone else who got in their line of fire. To take one example, in the late 1990s, Haggis went ballistic during a multi-year feud with a white hat hacker named Jay Dyson. First, they went after his internet service provider, deleting all their files and knocking them offline for 2 weeks. Later, they deleted files on Dyson's business website. For good measure, they harassed his wife with threatening messages, informing her, via her hacked email account, that all the Dyson family will pay for the mistakes of Big J. Upon learning about this and other attacks from the former BAO member I chatted with, I wrote, Biela, man, ruthless. Hacker, yeah, we were a fairly vicious bunch to the point that I dropped out of the scene. Biela, why? I mean, what was driving people? Is it just because people could? Hacker, hell if I know now, to be honest. There were massive hacker wars that went on that nobody knew about. IRC servers would vanish, ISPs would be wiped off the face of the earth for days or weeks. But it stayed within the scene. The media only ever caught hints of it. I mean, this was a time when hackers didn't want attention. People who talked to the press were media whores. We were a genuine subculture, our own news, our own celebrities, our own slang, our own culture. And I could not help but add, Biela, and your own wars. Still, Haggis could also be quite jocular. Once they defaced the Greenpeace website and posted what today might be considered a classically lulzy message meant to publicize the ordeal of an arrested phone freak and hacker named Kevin Mitnick. Free Kevin Mitnick, or we will club 600 baby seals. After going this deep, which is to say barely scratching the surface, I decided that my interlocutors were right. It was time to ease off on my pursuit of euphoria. Barely anything has been written about this famous troll, and for good reason. Trolling in the 1990s followed a different vector toward anonymity as well. Outside of these elite hidden hacker wars, ordinary users got their first bitter taste of trolling on Usenet, the seminal mega message board. In 1979, the internet existed as an academic and military network, the ARPANET, and access was limited to a select few. Naturally, a few engineers built a new system, Usenet, which they conceived of as the poor man's ARPANET. Initially invented for the sole purpose of discussing obscure technical matters, it quickly mushroomed, much to everyone's surprise, to include hundreds of lists with spirited and, at times, ferocious discussions. Technical subject matter was complemented by groups devoted to sex, humor, recipes, and, naturally, anti-Scientology. Usenet and other mailing lists are also where the term troll first came into common usage. It referred to people who did not contribute positively to discussions, who argued for the sake of arguing, or who were simply disruptive jerks, intentionally or not. List users frequently admonished others to stop feeding the trolls, a refrain still commonly seen today on mailing lists, message boards, and website comment sections. But Usenet also bred and fed the spectacular breed of troll who would intentionally sabotage conversations, leaving both list members and especially list administrators exasperated. There is no better example than Natochka Nezvanova, named after the titular character in Dostoevsky's failed first attempt at a novel. Appropriately, the name means nameless nobody. And just like Anonymous today, it is believed that many different individuals and groups have taken up the moniker, making it an apt example of what media scholar Marco De Serres describes as a multiple-use name, in which the same alias is adopted by organized collectives, affinity groups, and individual authors. Natochka Nezvanova's artist statement, published online, captures the mad, spirited flair driving this character. Interbody, artistic statement. Internet, where one may access the proposal and pertinent materials. Our bodies are the borders of our understanding. The universes are the body. The internet is the skin. This is my interbody. I am software. When I am alone, I want you to enter inside me. I wish to wear you. Dissolved and integrated, we are exploded into a nomadic, unstable topology of ceramic ribbons and microfluidic channels, of myriad phosphorescent gleams of the unassailable transpositions, of the visible signs of the invisible, and mysterious encounters in divisible dreams. Upon hearing this, you might find yourself, as I did, digging her imaginative, delusional sensibilities, unless you were on one of the mailing lists she demolished. Her character disrupted so frequently, with such adroitness, and on so many disparate lists and news groups, that different list administrators banded together on a dedicated list of their own, with the sole purpose of dealing with the trail of destruction she left behind. At my own current home university, McGill, she participated in a mailing list about Max, a visual programming language for music, audio, and media, but was booted in 2001 after threatening to sue particular list members. Here is a portion of the rationale for banning her. Second, after she was thrown off the McGill list, she initiated what could best be described as a terror campaign that included spam to anyone who posted to the Max list, denial of service attacks, and threatening and slanderous email sent to random individuals at McGill. I didn't see any point to subjecting myself and my coworkers to this type of harassment. However, it turns out that many of these acts are felonies. If this behavior recommences, the victims of the behavior can pursue legal remedies, and I would strongly suggest they do so. In reaction, someone on the list cried foul. So, censorship once more. In the 1990s, Usenet and many other booming mailing lists encouraged unrestrained free speech and were celebrated for it. But trolls like Natochka forced a debate, still with us today, about the limits of such speech. Should mailing lists and web page moderators curb offensive speech for the sake of civility, seen by some as necessary for a healthy community? Or should lists avoid censoring speech, no matter how objectionable, so that the internet might be a place where free speech reigns unconditionally? Of particular note, as we trace our trolling lineage through time, is the development of 4chan, an image board modeled on a popular Japanese image board called Futaba Channel, also known as 2chan. Chan is short for channel. It is here, perhaps more than anywhere else, where the populist type of trolling that is well known today first emerged. 4chan is unique for its culture of extreme permissibility, making questions of free speech largely irrelevant, fostered by a culture of anonymity embraced by its users. Naturally, it was on this board where the collective idea and identity of Anonymous emerged. Unlike Usenet, no one on 4chan is in the least bit disturbed by the uncivil speech that ricochets across the board every second of the day. In many respects, the board is explicitly conceived of as a say-anything zone. The grosser and more offensive, damn it, the better. Since it launched in 2003, 4chan has become an immensely popular, iconic, and opprobrious image board. Composed of over 60, at the time of this writing, topic-based forums ranging from anime to health and fitness, it is both the source of many of the internet's most beloved cultural artifacts, such as lolcats memes, and one of its most wretched hives of scum and villainy. The Random Forum, also called B, teems with pornography, racial slurs, and a distinctive brand of humor derived from defilement. It is where trolling once flourished. One B-tard, as the forum's denizens are called, explained to my class that everyone should have a good sense that B is an almost completely unfiltered clusterfuck of everything you could imagine, and lots of stuff you couldn't imagine or wouldn't want to. A post might include a naked woman with the demand, "Rate my wife." The next post might feature a particularly hard-to-stomach image of a severely mutilated body, but might then be followed by a nugget of light humor. Anonymous, December 9th, 2010, Thursday, 2651, number 293326XXX, just ate half a teaspoon of sodium bicarbonate. What do? Anonymous, December 9th, 2010, Thursday, 2824, number 293326XXX, bump. Anonymous, December 9th, 2010, Thursday, 2912, number 283326XXX. That's not very much. I suggest water, then burping. Anonymous, December 9th, 2010, Thursday, 3306, number 293327XXX. eat more and then chug red food dye and vinegar and wait for the reaction and run into the nearest room full of people and yell, I am the god of volcanoes, Toan Gladius. Generally speaking, though, much of the material is designed to be shocking to outsiders. A discursively constructed border fence meant to keep the uninitiated, a.k.a. noobs or new fags, far, far away. Nearly every category of person, from old-timers to new-timers, is labeled a fag. On 4chan, it is both an insult and term of endearment. We will see the suffix many times in this book. For insiders, it is the normal state of affairs, and one of the board's defining and appealing qualities. On 4chan, participants are strongly discouraged from identifying themselves, and most post under the default name Anonymous, as in the example before. Technically, 4chan keeps logs of IP addresses and doesn't do anything to keep visitors from being identified. Unless users cloak their IP addresses before connecting, the site's owner, founder, and system administrator, Chris Poole, a.k.a. Moot, has full access to them. He has even given them over to law enforcement to comply with legitimate investigations. This policy is widely known among users. But in at least a practical sense, and at least between its users as peers, the board functions anonymously, except for rare exceptions and the occasional instance where a subject of discussion must be identified using a photograph with a timestamp, users interact with no consistent nicknames or usernames. Posts are pushed off the front page very quickly, to be deleted from the server when they reach page 14, only surviving as long as users remain interested in the subject. It lowers personal responsibility and encourages experimentation, as media scholar Lee Nutilla put it. Experimentation includes generating memes. These are modifications of humorous images, videos, or catchphrases, some of which attain legendary status. Fierce trolling campaigns masterminded by Anonymous, though this has been less common in recent years, and incessant taunting and vitriol of other users, such as egging on individuals with suicidal ideation to just do it and become a hero. It must be noted, however, that there is also an outpouring of compassionate and empathetic advice, especially for those looking for relationship help, or when someone discovers a video of a cat being tortured. But this aspect is rarely featured in the news. All this occurs with the knowledge of impermanence. In contrast to mailing lists or many other kinds of online boards, there is no official archive. If a thread is not bumped back to the top by a time reply, it dies and evaporates. On an active channel like B, this entire life cycle occurs in just minutes. In this environment, it is difficult for a person to accrue status or reputation, much less fame. Against this backdrop of cacophonous experimentation and ephemera, a robust collective memory and identity has nevertheless formed around legendary trolling campaigns, all sorts of insider jokes, and artifacts like image macros. Aesthetically, the more extreme a piece of content is, the better, for it ensures the interest of participants and motivates replies to threads, keeping them alive. In particularly novel cases, an extreme piece of content can even circulate beyond the board, to distant lands like the message board community, Reddit, or bodybuilding.com, and eventually mass cultural awareness. Remember, lolcats got their start on 4chan. Trolls, in particular, focus on the collective pursuit of epic wins, just one form of content among many. To be clear, 4chan houses many trolls, but many participants steer clear of trolling activity. Still others avoid activity altogether. They are there as spectators or lurkers. It is almost impossible to pinpoint a day or event when trolling on 4chan was born. But by 2006, the name Anonymous was being used by participants to engage in trolling raids. These invasions would continue for many years, even after Anonymous was routinely deployed for activist purposes. For instance, in 2010, Anonymous sought to ruin a preteen girl named Jessie Slaughter after her homemade video monologues, which had gained some notoriety on tween gossip site Sticky Drama, were posted on 4chan. Anonymous was stirred to action by Slaughter's brazen boasts. She claimed in one video that she would pop a Glock in your mouth and make a brain slushy, and published her phone number, address, and Twitter username, inundating her with hateful emails and threatening prank calls, circulating photoshopped images of her and satiric remixes of her videos. When her father recorded his own rant, claiming to have backtraced her tormentors and reported them to the cyber police, he also became an object of ridicule. Slaughter, described by BTards as a lolzcow whore, is now memorialized on Urban Dictionary as the epitome of an 11-year-old slut slash poser slash internet reject slash scenecore wannabe. On the one hand, outlandish trolling raids and denigrating statements like lolzcow whore, or due to fail and AIDS from the Habbo Hotel raids, function for 4chan users like a repellent meant to keep naive users far away from their internet playground. On the other, when compared to most other arenas where trolls are bred, like Weave's GNAA, 4chan is a mecca of populist trolling. By populist, I simply mean that 4chan membership is available to anyone willing to cross these boundaries, put in the time to learn the argot, and, of course, stomach the gore. The etiquette and techniques that 4chan users employ are only superficially elitist. A former student of mine offered me the following insight. Exceptionally smart, he was also a troll. Or a goon, to be more precise, since that's what they call themselves on Something Awful, his website of choice at the time. Something Awful is like the exclusive country club of the internet, with a one-time $10 fee, a laundry list of rules very particular to SA, moderators who ban and probate, and community enforcement of good posts through ridicule. 4chan, on the other hand, is an organic free-for-all that doesn't enforce so much as engages an amorphous membership in a mega-death battle for the top humor spot. Anyone can participate in 4chan, and internet fame isn't possible in the same way it is on SA because everyone is literally anonymous. Whatever unfolds on the board, a joke, a long conversation, or a three-day trolling campaign, anonymity is essential to 4chan. One might call anonymity both its ground rule and its dominant cultural aspect, a core principle inherited by Anonymous, even in its pseudonymous material extension as hordes of Guy Fawkes mask wearers. On 4chan, there is an interplay between the function of anonymity, enabling pure competition without the interference of reputation or social capital, and the effects of anonymity, the memes, hacks, and acts of trolling that emerge and have real impact on the world. In contrast to Weave's egoistic acts of trolling, 4chan's anonymous internet hate machine collective action absolves individuals of responsibility in the conventional sense, but not in a collective sense. That is, Anonymous is open to anyone willing to subsume him or herself into a collective capable of gaining fame through events like the Habbo Hotel raids. Absent of any individual recognition, each activity is ascribed to a collective nom de plume, a reincarnation of Natochka Nezvanova. On 4chan, participants will also shame those seeking fame and attention, calling them name fags. As a trolling outfit, Anonymous achieved considerable media notoriety, just like Weave. The entity became, in certain respects, famous. However, while the trolling exploits of, on the one hand, Anonymous and 4chan users, and on the other hand, Weave, are connected by their tactical approaches, they are also foils of each other. Regardless of how far and wide the fame of Anonymous spreads, personal identity and the individual remain subordinate to a focus on the epic win, and especially the lulls. This subsumption of individual identity into collective identity is unusual in Western culture. Understanding its uptake is crucial to our knowledge of how Anonymous, as an activist group, came to be. It is very possible that the unsavory nature of Anonymous's early trolling activities motivated collectivity as a security feature. Participants probably had a desire to participate, to receive payment in lulls, without the risk of being identified and socially stigmatized. To understand these motivations and the powerful significance of an individual's willingness to subsume his or her identity, we will briefly ruminate on the culture of fame-seeking, of individualistic celebrity itself. Anonymous's trickster trick, defying individual celebrity through collective celebrity. Fame-seeking pervades practically every sphere of American life today, from the mass media, which hires Hollywood celebrities as news anchors, to the micromedia platforms that afford endless opportunities for narcissism and self-inflation, from the halls of academia, where superstar professors command high salaries, to sports arenas, where players rake in obscene salaries. Fame-seeking behavior reinforces what anthropologist David Graeber, building on the seminal work of C.B. McPherson, identifies as possessive individualism, defined as those deeply internalized habits of thinking and feeling, whereby we view everything around us primarily as actual or potential commercial property. How did 4chan, one of the seediest zones of the internet, hatch one of the most robust instantiations of a collectivist anti-celebrity ethic without its members even intending to? This ethic thrived organically on 4chan because it could be executed in such an unadulterated form. During a lecture for my class, a former anonymous troll and current activist explained the crucial role of 4chan in cementing what he designates as the primary ideal of anonymous. The posts on 4chan have no names or any identifiable markers attached to them. The only thing you are able to judge a post by is its content and nothing else. This elimination of the persona, and by extension everything associated with it, such as leadership, representation, and status, is the primary ideal of anonymous. This Anon, who was lecturing anonymously on Skype to my 10 enraptured students, immediately offered a series of astute qualifications about this primary ideal, the self-effacement of the individual. When Anonymous left 4chan in pursuit of activist goals in 2008, he explained, this ideal failed, often spectacularly. Once individuals interacted pseudonymously or met in person, status-seeking behaviors reasserted themselves. Individuals jockeyed and jostled for power. Nevertheless, the taboo against fame-seeking was so well entrenched on 4chan and was so valued for its success that it largely prevented, with only a few exceptions, these internal struggles for status from spilling over into public quests for personal fame. Later, we will see its greatest failure in the microecologies of hacker teams like AntiSec and LulzSec, analogous to rock stars in their ability to amass fame and recognition, and, not surprisingly, to spark the ire of some Anons, even while being admired for their lulzy and political antics. Once Anonymous left 4chan to engage in activism, the anti-celebrity-seeking ideal became more nuanced, incarnating into the desire for leaderlessness and high democracy, as this Anon put it. Attempts to put these principles into practice also resulted in missteps, particularly in the emergence of small teams with concentrations of power. But despite the fragmentation into teams and cabals, the overarching ideals remained in play. Adherence meant that anybody could call themselves anonymous and rightfully claim the name, as the lecturer explained. This freedom to take the name and experiment with it is precisely what enabled Anonymous to become the wily hydra it is today. But if we peek behind the ideal, the notion that Anonymous is everyone's property, an identity commons, so to speak, we see a much more complicated reality. And it was here, on this nuanced point, that this Anon ended his micro-lecture. I believe my students were both mesmerized and shocked that someone from Anonymous could be so smart and eloquent. I explained to them that Anonymous can be understood as what anthropologist Chris Kelty has jokingly called Contra the subaltern, the superaltern, those highly educated geeks who not only speak for themselves, but talk back loudly and critically to those who purport to speak for them. The anonymous guest lecturer continued, "Most of us are humor-driven, so it should be no surprise that we often contend with other anon-claiming groups we find out of favor, such as the new activist-only Occupy Wall Street anons, or the conspiracy theorists and other overly serious entities claiming the name. It's true, we cannot deny them the name, but the important thing to take away from this talk is that nowhere in the anonymous ideal was it ever stipulated that anonymous must stand together with or even like other anonymous. In fact, animosity and downright wars between anonymous-claiming entities is right in line with the original internet-based projects carried out by cultural anons. It is here that we might comprehend the complexity of anonymous. There is a singular subject and idea animating its spirit, and participants attempt to present this in a unified front. For the media, it is tempting to buy into this branding wholesale, to present anonymous as its values and its packaging. But the reality of the group's composition, in all its varied hues and tones, is impossible to present in any single sketch, even if anonymous uses a single name. Its membership comprises too many different networks and working groups, each of which is at varying odds with one another in varying moments. The very nature of this collective of collectives means that the accumulation of too much power and prestige, especially at a single point in virtual space, is not only taboo, but also functionally difficult. 4chan was ground zero for a robust anti-celebrity ethic, a value system opposed to self-aggrandizement and the apparatus of the mainstream media, one of the cancers killing B, as Anonymous likes to say. The ethic carried over to the activist incarnation of Anonymous. It is in these alternative practices of sociality, upending the ideological divide between individualism and collectivism, that we can recognize trolling's development into a principled weapon against monolithic banks and sleazy security firms. Collectivity is growing its market share. From the counter-corporate-controlled globalization movement of a decade ago to Anonymous and the recent explosion of leaderless movements like Occupy. This is often entirely lost on the mainstream media, which can't, or won't, write a story that does not normalize the conversion of an individual into a celebrity or leader, complete with individual heroism or tragic moral failings. This, of course, is not the proclivity of journalism and journalists alone. Most of Western philosophy, and in turn much of Western culture more generally, has posited the self, the individual, as the site of epistemic inquiry. It is hard to shake millennia of philosophical thinking on a topic, intellectual thinking that is also cultural common sense. It is for this reason that Anonymous, whether in its trolling or activist incarnations, acted as a jujitsu-like force of trickery, its machinations incommensurable with the driving logic of the mainstream corporate media and dominant sensibilities of the self. It drove journalists a bit batty, which I got to witness firsthand as I brokered, a bit trickster-like myself, between Anonymous and the media. I often helped the media cross the deep chasm in baby steps as they tried to locate a leader, or at least a character, who might satisfy the implicit demands of their craft. It is perhaps due to this very resistance to journalistic convention, to the desire to discover, reveal, or outright create a celebrity leader, that journalists were compelled to cover Anonymous. The hunt for a spokesperson, a leader, a representative, was in vain, at least until the state entered the fray and began arresting hackers. But for the most part, media outlets were offered few easy characters around which to spin a story. What began as a network of trolls has become, for the most part, a force for good in the world. The emergence of Anonymous from one of the seediest places on the internet is a tale of wonder, of hope, and of playful illusions. Is it really possible that these ideals of collectivity and group identification, forged as they were in the hellish, terrifying fires of trolling, could transcend such an originary condition? Did the cesspool of 4chan really crystallize into one of the most politically active, morally fascinating, and subversively salient activist groups operating today? Somewhat surprisingly, yes. Let's see how. Chapter 2. Project Chanology. I came for the lulls, but stayed for the outrage. Various contingencies converged to awaken the trickster trolls from their unsavory 4chan underworld. But if we were to single out one event most responsible for this, it would be the leaking onto the internet of a Scientology video featuring Tom Cruise, Scientology's celebrity of celebrities. Streisand was in full effect, quipped one anon. The Streisand effect is a well-known internet phenomenon wherein an attempt to censor a piece of information has the inverse effect. More people want to see it in order to understand the motivation for the censorship, and thus it spreads much more widely than it would have if left alone. The phenomenon is named after Barbara Streisand's attempt in 2003 to bar, via a multi-million-dollar lawsuit, aerial photographs of her Malibu home from being published. The photographer was only trying to document coastal erosion. Before the lawsuit, the image of her home had been viewed online only 6 times, but after the case went public, more than 420,000 people visited the site. The Tom Cruise Scientology video was subject to a similar dynamic. Its circulation was unstoppable. In the video, Tom Cruise epitomizes Scientology's narcissistic worldview. Being a Scientologist, when you drive by an accident, it's not like anyone else, he says, chuckling with self-satisfaction. As you drive past, you know you have to do something about it, because you know you're the only one that can really help. Internet geeks, along with almost everyone else, viewed the video as a pathetic, not to mention hilarious, attempt to bestow credibility on pseudoscience via celebrity. As Tom Cruise cackled to himself in the video, the internet community cackled, albeit for very different reasons, with him. The video initially reached the internet not through the efforts of Anonymous, but through, fittingly enough, an anonymous leak. The video was originally slated to appear on NBC to coincide with the release of Tom Cruise's unauthorized biography, but at the last minute the network got cold feet. However, critics of Scientology worked swiftly to ensure that the video found its way onto the web. Former Scientologist Patty Moher, working alongside longtime critic Patricia Greenway, FedExed a copy to Mark Bunker, who uploaded a video and sent a link to investigative journalist Mark Ebner, who in turn sent it to other news sources. Gawker, Radar, and other sites picked it up on January 13, 2008, linking to a video Bunker had posted, he thought, with password protection. He was wrong. I woke up a few hours later to discover that the one chapter that had Cruise's monologue was accidentally not set to private, he said later. It had been viewed about 20,000 times while I slept and was downloaded and mirrored multiple times on multiple accounts by people who had read the Gawker and Radar stories and other coverage of the video. YouTube subsequently removed Bunker's videos hosted on the channel Tom Cruise Book, along with the entire channel, likely at the behest of a Scientology copyright notice. On January 15th, Gawker republished the video with a short, punchy description fit for millions of eyeballs. Let me put it this way. If Tom Cruise jumping on Oprah's couch was an 8 on the scale of scary, this is a 10. The Religious Technology Center, the arm of Scientology dealing with matters of intellectual property, took immediate action, threatening publishers with lawsuits if they did not remove the video. Gawker ended its article boldly. It's newsworthy, and we will not be removing it. The cat was out of the bag. Scientology was furious and about to furiously unfurl lawsuits. And then all hell broke loose when the Hive, as Anonymous was then often called, decided to get involved. On January 15th at 7:37:37 p.m., the gates of the underworld opened with a historic thread regarding Scientology-oriented activism. Anonymous, January 15th, 2008, Tuesday. 1937-37. Number 5105-1816. I think it's time for B to do something big. People need to understand not to fuck with B and talk about nothing for 10 minutes and expect people to give their money to an organization that makes absolutely no fucking sense. I'm talking about hacking or taking down the official Scientology website. It's time to use our resources to do something we believe is right. It's time to do something big again, B. Talk amongst one another, find a better place to plan it, and then carry out what can and must be done. It's time, B. Technically, and geeks make it a habit to geek out on technical specificities, a call to arms post came earlier on 4chan as well as on 7-Eleven-chan. Apparently, at 6:11 p.m., I was told. Nevertheless, this seemed to be the post that spurred the largest number of trolls into action. While the general mood of the thread was one of hyperbolic confidence and exuberance, others were understandably skeptical about taking on, much less taking down, this extraordinarily powerful organization. They were well aware that targeting the Church of Scientology might be invoking Tom Cruise's blockbuster movie series, Mission Impossible. Anonymous, January 15th, 2008, Tuesday, 1946-35, number 5105-2578, Mission Impossible. A random image board cannot take down a pseudo-religion with the backing of wealthy people and an army of lawyers. Even if every person who has ever browsed B once joined in on a mass invasion, it would still amount to nothing. Plus, if anyone got found out, they would have 500 lawyers up their ass before they could say litigation. Scientologists are famous for hounding critics. Anonymous, January 15th, 2008, Tuesday, 1950-22, number 5105-2862. Then don't get involved if you don't think it's possible. The next day, a prescient message on B issued the rallying cry for all Anonymous-related anti-Scientology activities, gathered under the slogan Chanology, and outlined the events to come. Anonymous, January 16, 2008, Wednesday, 1747-44, number 5113-4054. On January 15, 2008, war was beginning. Scientology's site is already under heavy bombardment. It's loading quite slowly. But this is just the tip of the iceberg, the first assault in many to follow. We are winning a minor victory, but without the united support of the Chan, Scientology will brush off this attack, and it will be doomed to nothing more than an entry in ED. 4chan, answer the call. Join the Legion against Scientology. Help in its demise, in its long-awaited doom. For decades, this tyranny has existed, corrupting the minds of the weak. Although hilarious, it's rather pathetic. We must destroy this evil and replace it with a greater one, Chanology. For when we are victorious, the Chans will stand united in a new chapter of anonymous existence and batshit insanity. We will have begun our world takeover. If we can destroy Scientology, we can destroy whatever we like. The world will be but our plaything. Do the right thing, 4chan. Become not just a part of this war, become an epic part of it. The largest of the Chans, you hold the key of manpower, what the Legion is in desperate need of. Forward, Anonymous. United, we, the Legion, are unstoppable. Too long, didn't read. We're taking down Scientology. Join up or get the fuck out. No sci-fags allowed in this thread. Faster than anyone could say Hail Xenu, Xenu being the dastardly evil alien overlord of the galaxy, at least according to Scientology's version of history, these trolls, followed by myself shortly after, headed to the Party Van IRC network, an Anon hangout, to watch the trolling festivities explode. Or at least that's how a core participant described it in a lecture to one of my university classes. The unified bulk of Anonymous collaborated through massive chat rooms to engage in various forms of ultra-coordinated motherfuckery. For very short periods of time between January 15th and the 23rd, Scientology websites were hacked and DDoSed to remove them from the internet. The Dianetics telephone hotline was completely bombarded with prank calls. All black pieces of paper were faxed to every fax number we could get our hands on. And the secrets of their religion were blasted all over the internet. I also personally scanned my bare ass and faxed it to them because fuck them. Watching this epic raid take shape in real time, it was easy for me to understand why the geeks and hackers making up the ranks of Anonymous targeted Scientology. It is their evil doppelganger. I did not end up in this IRC channel by accident. I was already immersed in the cultural tensions between geeks/netizens and Scientologists. 1 year earlier, I had been living in Edmonton, one of Canada's coldest cities, in